of you, ladies and gentlemen, you know what you are. For the first time on any screen, their lives, stories of women who love women and men that love men. See their side. Hear them out. Don't have a closed mind. Be open before making your decision. See gay liberation. Every family with relatives is involved. Out of the closet and into the streets. Gay liberation.
Took his son from his home, yeah, they pulled him apart. They took a daughter from her home, they were forced to depart. Amongst the others on the train, they called the Iron Horse. Another native fell victim to the Holocaust. The devils creep to the village, popes and his priest stealing children from their homes. So they placed them in a school to erase them and undo what they labeled as savage. Before the gates of long hair, she had tossed in a pound like it was garbage stripped down from your custom attire. Your skin scrubbed till it bleed, put his clothes in a fight, and various items were placed in with arms. Give him a Bible, teach him to read, preach him indeed. If he speaks one word of his tongue, no song sung from the homeland. Which he learned as a young buck from an old sage in the village to a school made a break. Where they planned was to kill him, save the man was the model. Sodomized by a priest, traumatized, getting beat, cooling rations when he eat. Many died cause they starved, no one notified, buried in the yard for not following the cross. All the verses from my ancestors, your heart beats through me. They took his son from his home, yeah, they pulled him apart. They took a daughter from her home, they were forced to depart. Amongst the others on the train, they called the Iron Horse. Another native fell victim to the Holocaust.
Sounds good. Forget, I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.
She came from a family of five. She was nine at the time when they came to pay the people a visit. With a man who translated the language, they promised beautiful things that she intended. Without mentioning the evil they imposed, his hands clammy and they go as he shakes with a smile on his face. Now she on her way to Carlisle with no knowledge of her fate. He tell her, calm down, calm down. We at the gate, she see the faces of her schoolmates saddened and broke. They sat her down, cut her hair and made her wear proper clothes to look civilized. No more living like a tribe lies. So if you try to speak a word in your tongue,
you are listening to Queer Review in association with the Pride Library on CHOW 94.9. Today I will be speaking with Albert McLeod, director of the Two-Spirited People of Manitoba, about the effects of residential schools on two-spirited people, followed by an interview with Robert Carrington Sugarbaker on the work of his charitable fundraising organization, the Royal Imperial Sovereign Court of London, Ontario.
Today I'm very happy to have a guest with us, Albert McLeod. I just wanted to tell you that I was really excited to see the work that you've been doing online. I saw it on firstperspectives.ca, a press release that you did, and I've been following the residential school issue for over 3.5 years now. When I first heard of it, completely took me by surprise, like most settlers or Canadian society. I read intensively about it, but I've never heard of it being framed in the context of two-spirited people and the effects that it's had. Could you tell me a little bit about what two-spirited is, just for the listeners who've never heard the term?
Well, I think for Aboriginal people, because we're in a process of cultural revitalization and decolonization, you know, renaming ourselves or naming ourselves to more appropriate names other than what, you know, Western society has given us, has been a part of that liberation movement. And so in 1990, at a Two-Spirit gathering here in Manitoba, the term Two-Spirited People was coined, and it seemed to resonate with a lot of participants who were primarily gay, lesbian, transgender, Aboriginal people. And so that has been adopted since then across North America with different groups. Other Aboriginal people or Native American people still call themselves gay and lesbian or transgender. But for some, you know, the two-spirit term really is, it's a Western term, it's English, obviously, but it really speaks about within the cultures and languages, there were words and terms that did describe a specific role for people who were gay and lesbian. And I think when the languages, when the terms do come back into the language, or you know, are beginning to be used again, that term may not be as relevant.
So, could you describe some of the roles that you mentioned two-spirited people fulfilled? And I know that's a broad question because there are so many nations, and there still are so many nations. But could you elaborate on what you know?
Well, you know, there's a lot of work that's being done by anthropologists and historians around that. And I think with any society around the world, there, you know, there are gays and lesbians, and that, you know, beyond the modern terminology we use, in India, there's Hijra is the name of a transgender person who kind of lives a role that's between it's primarily a female role, but there's certain cultural roles and religious roles that a Hijra would play. And even today, like blessing of newborn children would be one. So depending on the groups, and Kent Monkman, who's a Cree artist here from Manitoba, has done some artwork around those roles where, you know, there would be transgender women who would obviously dress as females within the society and marry males, and also a description of a dandy who would have been a gay male in a sort of a male role in the culture. And a lot of the cultural roles are defined by gender, but again, there's this openness to difference in that how those roles are interpreted. And I know in some cultures, a male dressing as a female represents fertility, and that fertility is a very important facet or part of survival in terms of if that group of people, corn, you know, the harvest of corn would be an annual event. So rain and the earth and all of that would have been very important. So I think in Western society, you know, femininity and how it's observed in males is really an issue. There's a lot of homophobia and transphobia. But looking back at more ancient cultures, there was a deeper understanding of that and its significance related to fertility.
I want to speak a little bit about the residential schools because, you know, there's a lot of different opinions about it, and still many people are not really sure how to place it, either theoretically or in history and whatnot. Would you like to explain to the best you can what exactly it was?
Well, the school period was a process of trying to, from a colonial perspective, to civilize to European standards, you know, indigenous peoples in Canada and the United States. And so it was thought the best way to do that was to give Aboriginal children a Western education, but also to remove them from any cultural influences from their families and communities, to sort of disconnect what they saw as something that had no value. And so that lasted for over 100 years in Canada, and it affected many generations, in that some of the students, you know, many of them didn't learn their language, had very strained relationships with their siblings and or families and communities. And so the students, the surviving students, a number of years ago, had a class action lawsuit against the government of Canada in that they were abused in those schools, some of them, and they didn't thrive. You know, it wasn't a good education for many, so they, you know, sort of the theory or logic behind this type of education was not, didn't come to flourish for many Aboriginal people who were living in poverty and estranged from their families. So this process now with the students, because a settlement came about with the Government of Canada in 2006, that would educate Canadians about that history, as well as provide opportunities for former students to tell their stories. So we're right through the Indian Residential School Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is housed in Manitoba. That is a process for the former students as well as other Canadians to learn about that history. So we're just coming into this period of actually learning what happened and what its impact has been, and really hearing firsthand from the students, former students, what it was like.
Yes, yes. I know that I've when I first heard of it, I heard of it from a film called Unrepentant. It was Kevin Annett and Canada's genocide. So I know there's a lot of people who can see this as a genocidal thing too, and some of the stories and policies were just quite shocking to hear personally that it happened in Canada. But
Right now, one of the eight definitions of genocide at the United Nations is cultural genocide, which is exactly what happened in Canada, which is removing children from one culture and raising them in another. And so now, today, it would be illegal, you know, at many levels. But just to note that that initial policy that set out was, a violation of human rights.
Oh, yes, at the very least. Now, to talk about the conference, I haven't been able to get too much more information about what happened. Can you explain? I know you did one the year before that was similar, I think. I saw a print off of that. But could you explain what happened? Well, just summarize what happened at the presentation / conference in February?
Well, this conference was initially they expected 1,000 people, and they got 2,500, which really speaks to the interest and that people do have something to contribute to this process and this movement. And so it was based on the intergenerational impacts of residential schools, which is a bit different from addressing the issues of former students or staff who worked in the schools or the relationship with the church groups that were involved in running the schools. So this one is a bit more around intergenerational, psychological, cultural, and community impacts. There was a lot of academics talking about, what their analysis is of the present-day populations and how they could have been impacted by the residential school legacy. The other aspect was talking about the hidden legacy of the school, and that's a term from the actual promotion, and that's what interested me in that, I've been doing sort of talking about gays and lesbians and two-spirited people for 30 years, is I wanted to ensure that two-spirited people were included in this discourse because I perceive it to be a hidden legacy of the residential schools in that, the loss of the words and the language and the loss of the ability to talk about being gay or lesbian in a positive way was really an outcome of that period.
And so what happened, I know that there was the broader conference, which was called something like the Hidden Legacy, right?
Well, there was workshops, and we managed to get our workshop in.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bit of a struggle, but with the organizing committee, and this was hosted by the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, which represents First Nations in Manitoba, as well as this was a national conference. So there's people right across Canada. And so there was different types of workshops, and the one that we proposed and was accepted eventually was around understanding two-spirited people and the impact of the residential schools, and which really resulted in homophobia and transphobia. And so we went in and we did our workshop twice that day, and it was well received. But I think overall in the whole process, that just the inclusion really was a step forward, I thought, at quite a high-profile level.
Mm-hmm. Can you I don't know how much you can share because I don't know the confidentiality of it all and everything like that, but what was the main highlighted points that your workshop provided,
well,
and what was the feedback?
Part of what I do is I do a historical perspective, just sort of the, step by step, in that there's a lot of, historical and the cultural evidence that, gays and lesbians were included in the community and there wasn't segregation or separation, and that's changed over, relationship that's occurred through colonization with Europeans, And so that's kind of where I sort of walked the participants through. We also had a person who did attend residential school, who was a transgender First Nations person, and talked about the experience and the impact that transphobia has had on her life, as well as, you know, the struggles that she has today, and not having a good education, being unemployed, being involved in the sex trade. So I think it was very evident to the audience that they could see the impacts of the residential school era, but also of homophobia and transphobia.
Now, can you explain a little bit more of what else the Two-Spirited People of Manitoba has been up to as of recent, and what are some of your future plans?
Well, we hosted the 22nd International Two-Spirit Gathering last September here in Manitoba, and it was our third time of hosting this event. And one of its foundational values is that it be alcohol and drug-free, and I think that's been one of the most successful parts. And in the evaluation, it was actually mentioned by some of the participants, is that being alcohol and drug-free just enabled them to feel safe and to stay at the event. It's a four-day event, and it's a shared event between Canada and the United States, and this year it's going to be going to BC. So I think that event is where we create our own safe places based on our needs, where we meet elders, and we have opportunities to learn from each other what our life experiences have been, as well as learn about the culture, the various Aboriginal cultures in North America. So that's one thing that we continue to do, is to facilitate participation in this broader movement between Canada and the United States. As well as we continue to be involved in research, and we're looking at, I guess, the recommendation from the housing study or mobility study is looking at transitional housing and skills development for Two-Spirited people in Winnipeg.
To find out more about Two-Spirited People, there are several books on the topic at the Pride Library at the University of Western Ontario. Okay, today's guest is Robert Carrington Sugarbaker, Emperor One, is that correct?
That's right.
You are the head of the Royal Imperial Sovereign Court of London, which is a branch of the imperial court system. Thank you for being with us. I wanted to bring you on the show because your organization is important to the London community, but also your organization has recently done a fundraiser for the Pride Library, which Queer Review is in association with, so I wanted to thank you right off for that. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well today, thank you.
Great.
And yourself?
Not bad. Can you explain the organization, the broader organization, and then get into how it relates and works?
A broad explanation of not just our chapter, but all of our chapters across North America. We are a not-for-profit organization, basically raising money for other organizations who receive limited or no government funding whatsoever. So we raise money for places like Camp Wendake, which does receive some money, but we raise a little extra, so it gives another child who is living with HIV or AIDS a chance to go to camp for a week and just be a kid and not have any worries. We've done stuff for the London Humane Society in the past, the Skowronski Fund, which gives money to patients who are in hospital that need to have a telephone or television. You know, stuff like that. And as you had stated earlier, recently we had done a fundraiser for the Pride Library there at Weldon Library at Western.
And what made you decide to do that for Pride?
Well, I didn't decide that we had to do it. We were kind of told we had to do it, which the head of our organization, Nicole the Great, Queen Mother of the Americas, she is actually our titular head of state right across North America. When she was here in September of last year, a friend and I had taken Nicole for a tour up to Weldon Library to see the Pride Library, and she had met Professor Miller. She had a tour of the library and was absolutely amazed that for a city the size of London and as conservative as London is, any place that Nicole has been across North America, albeit San Diego, San Francisco, New York, and even in Europe, London is the only one that actually has a physical library within a library with all gay, bisexual, transgendered related information and books. She was very, very impressed with London for that. So she made a decree that the Diamond Courts, being London, Toronto, Hamilton, St. Catharines, and Buffalo, were to do a joint fundraiser for the library, and we did it on March 18th.
Tell us a little bit about the environment of that night, because it seems like you have quite a heavy history, a tradition of you meaning the organization of flamboyant dressing and a quite a lively time. I get the impression of, is this what happened?
It can be. We are based within the gay community, so we do deal a lot with female impersonation, drag queens, and personally I do find it different. Drag queens are very flamboyant and out there. Female impersonators are actually impersonating, you know, a star or something like that. But it can be pomp and circumstance. There are certain rules that one does follow. There are certain ways of dressing, etc., especially when you tend to be a figurehead such as myself. So, you know, you dress up, you wear crowns, you know, you act to the point of almost like actual royalty without getting to that absolute point. We're no William and Kate, that's for sure, but you know, there is a bit of pomp and circumstance that goes about it. And the idea is to have fun.
Right.
It is a volunteer organization, and, I mean, everyone who is involved does it out of the goodness of their heart and to raise money for certain places that need or that we see an actual desire to actually raise money for, and the Pride Library was one of them. Nice having James there, so he participated in the whole evening. And he was just overjoyed at the end of the night when we did our draws. He actually won something, and one of the other young ladies that was with him as well, she won something. So, I mean, everybody walked away with a very good feeling that night.
Are you continuing on to find a new organization to do some fundraising for? Is there anything in the future that you'll be working on?
Well, this year with the organization, we're raising money for Camp Wendake, which is something that we've pretty much done every year for almost the last 20 years that we've been in existence.
Wow.
And we're also raising money for another organization called Lifespin, which helps those who are on Ontario Works or disability find housing. They supply, you know, information for where they can get housing, food, free clothing, furniture, anything that they can do along that line. So we're actually, those are the two that we're generally raising money for this year. As far as the Pride Library goes, it is probably something that I will take on as a yearly event here in London and have the Diamond Courts come in to help support it as well. But I mean, this fundraiser and everything, Nicole made it quite clear, and it was sent out to our over 80 chapters right across North America, including Honolulu, Hawaii, and Anchorage, Alaska. This was happening, and it got a lot of interest from other courts in other states and in other provinces, to the point I was in Vancouver the beginning of March, and Ted North, who was the very first Empress in Canada, wanted to know how it went and wanted information on the library. So I would imagine that the Pride Library itself will be getting emails from different courts across North America wanting to know where they could send money to, books, anything like that.
Yes, it's quite a large organization.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Nicole had also made mention while we were in Vancouver, and Professor Miller was there to receive an award from Nicole, that the ICS and the Heir Apparents Council, which is a group of individuals who, it's kind of like a line of succession. Each time the head of our organization steps down after about 4 or 5 years, we have someone who steps in to take over. So I believe next year Nicole is stepping down and someone else will be taking her place. But the ICS is actually looking at the Pride Library here in London to actually house all of the past 45 years worth of history of the court itself.
Wow. That's great.
I mean, that's something I would have thought they would have done down in San Francisco or San Diego where everything had started, but they're looking at housing everything here in London, Ontario.
Wow. What an honor.
I thought so as well. I mean, I have my own bone of contention with the city from time to time and sometimes the small-mindedness of people, but with everything that's happened with the Pride Library and everything that our organization is at, it boosts a little bit more pride in the city that I have chosen to live in.
Yeah, we've been recently just overwhelmed with the Pride Library. We've had about 4 major waves of donations, and we've got so much material now. People are so willing to contribute. It wasn't really expected.
I was asked a lot of questions in Vancouver about the Pride Library, and I told everyone, you know, do a Google search on it. You can find it through, I hope I say it right, Wikipedia and everything. So I imagine a lot of the courts from the United States will be looking into it. And you know, they could be doing their own little thing where they would send money or information on their own chapters and stuff to be housed.
People can find out information about your organization, possibly even how to get involved, at impcourt.org, is that correct?
Yep, impcourt.org.
And the whole history is there too, the foundation.
The whole history is there. You can find out about the court, when it started, where it started, chapter information, court calendar as to what's coming up, everything, including the ICS National Fundraising Campaign.
You are listening to Queer Review on CHRW 94.9. Queer Review broadcasts every other Tuesday at 6 p.m. To download this episode and others, please visit queerreviewradio.blogspot.com.